Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Ryan. So, one thing I wanted to allude to is that not all questions are susceptible to predictive analytics. So when we went down this journey, we had to really think about what are the things that offer the most impact for changing public health. And so really looking along the notion of inspections, resource allocation, and those kinds of issues. So the question is more, but also you have to think about what approaches might work best, right? So in the mammography approach, it was partnering with a particular organization with particular capacity. In the West Nile approach, it was a competition and crowdsourcing. In the lead approach, it was partnership with an academic institution. And when I'm going to speak to food, it was really a group of partners that came together around optimizing inspections with analytics for redesigning how food protection might happen at a local health department or state health department. And so Ryan and I will walk you through this work. Our colleague Tom Shank, City of Chicago's Chief Data Officer, couldn't be here to deliver this presentation, but he's been an extraordinary partner in all of this work, as well as that department. No relationship to disclose for either of us. And so the notion was, what were the existing challenges when it came to food protection? There were limited resources, 32 inspectors for nearly a little over 15,000 food establishments for, you know, a city population of 2.7 million. There are competing priorities, as Ryan alluded to earlier. And there's policy infrastructure challenges really around inertia that impedes change efforts and working with existing contracts, and also alluding to the notion of the distinction between correlation and causation. And predictive analytics really highlights that distinction. Can decisions be made based on correlations? And the incentives for really innovating around this issue is that food protection for many years has been done the same way. Really that there was sanitarians were focused in a particular area that they had always been to and responding to complaints as well. But really importantly, that foodborne illness is a critical issue for our country. Many foodborne illnesses go unreported. One in six Americans, nearly 48 million people get sick. 128,000 are hospitalized, which causes a downstream effect of suffering, loss of productivity from jobs, high costs of healthcare, and nearly 3,000 die of foodborne disease. And so, really, 2.9% of those who become sick report their illness, and most do not seek medical care. So this is really an important issue that offered an opportunity to use predictive analytics to get out in front of and be proactive rather than reactive. And really, this is the municipal code, the city code. The Department of Health shall inspect all food establishments at least once every 6 months and as often as necessary to determine that the requirements of this municipal code are being complied with. This is the context we start with. And as I alluded to earlier, predictive analytics is old news for many other industries. It's now coming to healthcare over the last 4 or 5 years and offers real opportunity and promise. And for the issue around food inspections, it was an opportunity to allocate resources more efficiently, to prioritize inspections, to increase efficiency, and to prevent illnesses that may lead to outbreaks that have a downstream effect. And really, the objective for this initiative was to order inspections to increase the speed of finding critical violations at retail food establishments. So you see what the order typically is, and the order typically gets followed, but can a data-driven approach identify those most at risk and you intervene earlier? And so this is really, you know, a nice picture of our wonderful city that you all are getting to enjoy this week with fantastic weather. But what you'll see, I'll put up, is that based on where you are, what the time of day it is, what the surrounding environment is, what the temperature may be, it contributes to differences in risk scores across the city. So this 23%, 11%, 7% are really risk scores in those various locations. And so we brought together a group of partners that really were dedicated to improving this process and also improving how we do food protection and getting out in front of this issue. So Civic Consulting Alliance was a lead in sort of helping us project manage, and they do pro bono work with cities and nonprofit organizations in Chicago, but certainly across the country as well. Department of Innovation and Technology has really developed and launched the Chicago Tech Plan, and it's changing lives through many different initiatives related to digital technology, informatics, and data science. And Commissioner Brennan Berman and Tom Shanker was leading that charge and effort with support and leadership from Mayor Emanuel. And the Department of Public Health and Commissioner Dr. Julie Morita have really, along with Dr. Shukair, as a former commissioner, have taken a strong approach to collaboration and partnership in data science analytics. And I think that this constellation of partners came together at the right time, in the right place, and in the right way to really deliver on this opportunity. And Allstate does pro bono work on Friday. And so the interesting thing about Allstate is that they really cared about improving the health of the city. And so they jumped on with a couple of their data scientists on this project. And really the fundamental piece of this was that, you know, unlike some of the other projects required personal health information, that this was really all about open data. And the data that's already on the city portal, and that's the data we use to develop and test and train the model. So the model's objective is, can we use historical data to predict which inspections are most likely to have a critical violation? And so a binary response model, and the observations are looking across history, so retrospective, and a positive outcome in this model was the presence of any violation numbered 1 to 14, which are the number of violations that the citations occur for. And these are the different data sources that compose the model: business licenses, weather, food inspection history, sanitation complaints, which had a number of variables, garbage cart requests, which had a number of variables, and crime, which had a number of variables. And so a lot of the work initially was bringing this together and also thinking about the process. And so the inspection data was combined with the historical data, developed the model, and you'll see some of the variables there under historical data. And then under the model, the different types of statistical and mathematical approaches used to develop the model. And when we looked at the optimization, these looked at a whole set of variables and ultimately came down to these 13 variables that were significant looking at retrospective data and historical data. So risk is level 1, 2, or 3, the levels of risk in the various facilities in Chicago. Ward, inspection type, last count, tobacco retail, average temperature being high 3 days prior to inspection, and other sanitation code violations, et cetera. So we did an initial test with the model, the data, and saw that when we did this experiment, there was a two-time improvement over the current business practice, which was the way that inspections had been done. And you saw a 2 times lift when you looked at the sorted high to low based on the predictive score. So the first model was built using data prior to 2014 and tested in early 2014. And then the second model was built in response to what we learned from the first model, which we completed in the summer of 2014, and then tested that in November based on actual inspection results from September and October. And you'll see here that the model is built on historically available data, but then tested on potentially future data. And this just outlines some of the steps to the training and evaluation. So you had to run it through the historical food data, model fit it, and then what we learned also was that there was some impact from new sanitarian hires, and when the reassignments happened to evaluate the model, that affected the model. And so, as you saw in here, in January 1 of 2014, all sanitariums were reassigned to based on testing the model, and so then ran the model evaluation experiment with normal business practice versus using the model for 3 months in early 2014. And so the research really revealed an opportunity to find and deliver results faster. Within the first half of work, meaning within the first half of the inspections done, 69% of the critical violations would have been found by inspectors using a data-driven approach. And during the same period, only 55% of the violations were found using the traditional method. So you see that there is almost a 15% lift using a data science data-driven approach. And that the food inspection model is able to deliver results faster, so we were able to find violations a week earlier than we otherwise would have using a traditional model. So the rate of finding violations is accelerated in a 60-day pilot. So we're finding those potential violations sooner and acting on them sooner, which means keeping safe, but also helping our restaurants get safer and better thereafter. And really in optimizing food inspections, we discover that critical violations sooner rather than later reduces the risk of patrons becoming ill, which helps reduce medical expenses, lost time at work, and even a limited number of families. You'll see initially that the slope will be steep and then will level off because you're finding those most at risk early on as opposed to later. And now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ray Edmonds, to walk you through some of the other components.
So this is part of the operationalizing that I was speaking of earlier in West Nile. So there's this dashboard, it's not fancy. You need to assign the inspectors to the restaurants within certain zip codes that weren't already inspected. If the prediction keeps pulling up, we don't just keep sending because the model is telling us so. So there's a 6-month gap before we inspect them again. Other thing is that these restaurants by law have to be inspected. So it's not picking on them necessarily through this predictive model that forecasts. Instead of, say, inspecting them randomly across time, and then someone's due in November, say that restaurant is at a higher risk, we just move them up to January. So that's a good way to think of how this application works. So it's really easy to use. You can click by zip code and click by inspector and do a printout and hand them to the sanitarians, thus giving an orderly method to the inspection and assignments, previously random and a lot of work by the director, who's just also helped create this application because you have to learn her business process for this to work. It's very hard to start introducing a new way of doing things. It creates a lot of friction, especially if you want to make something successful. So you work with the program. Tom Shank and his folks over there at DoIt worked with Jaren and the sanitarium there to build this application. The other part of this application, they started adding some features, is some statistical analysis that will help with reporting for the program. So it updates nightly. That's the automation I was talking about earlier. And it makes it easier, that shiny product that we're always talking about. It'd be nice if we started adding more analytics to it. But over time, when they find time, the competing priorities part, we'll have a nice shiny product for the food program to use. We also put it on GitHub, and I didn't have it here, but it's been forked several times, I think 20, 30 times. And the crowdsourcing we mentioned earlier, they started finding mistakes and sending in corrections and recommendations. So that's one positive aspect of keeping the code open. And the model is on GitHub, and I think that's all we're doing today. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think we lost our moderator, so I think I don't know. Oh, there you are.
I didn't see you.
We're open for questions. Oh, you want to dance? They want Jay to dance? That's the first question. Go ahead, in the back.
What kind of software do you use for the prediction for forecasting?
For which one?
Hold up.
They're all in R and Python.
R and Python?
Yeah. The LED is in Python. It was built by Data Science for Social Good, initially in R, and Eric likes Python. There's reasons for that he can, if he wants to, which I've heard. I don't think it comes up. You have to stand up. I think it would be interesting just to hear why he switched it from R to Python.
Yeah, I mean, I think both of those environments are good for these kinds of projects. We eventually switched to Python because of the scale of the model was getting quite big, and there are some advantages to working in Python in that situation. More questions?
And the food one is written in R,
And the West Nile is a mix. Any other questions?
How long does it take to run the West Nile model?
We haven't tested it. You know, we just got the model, and my point was just getting models is not the important piece, because DSSG built the lead model, we'll say crudely built maybe, but it was built well in 2 months, and same with the West Nile, the competition. I wouldn't say it takes 2 months to build the model, but it varies. Yeah, you can refine it, but it took about 2 months for us to get the model. That's one aspect, so that's why we put the models out in public. Operationalizing it, I think, is the harder part, and Eric would agree with me probably that was it's still hard. And then same with the food. We had to build an application that would help the inspectors. Otherwise, you have this model and it's just giving predictions. How does it fit into the normal business process? So I think every city, it'll be unique. That won't be a standard, but the models have a potential for being that.
Yes. If I can clarify, how long does it take to model a data transmission? Like a switch swap lens you have in the area model. I think it's becoming increasingly complex over the years, and it takes actually a large amount of time to get the data.
Yeah.
But I was just curious, you know, what I'm doing.
Yeah, what's that? I'm not sure if it was even tested. It was not tested live at all.
Yeah. It was tested on historical data and then future data, and so that it doesn't work the same way necessarily that the malaria model you're speaking of would work.
Okay.
We've had a lot of conversations with different cities. I know Eric, not you specifically, but Joe, also postdoc there, spoke to Rhode Island and I believe Boston, Baltimore. I spoke with New York City with regards to their epidemiologist there that heads up their food surveillance program. So we're informed, we communicate with everybody. Publishing wise, there is a paper out on the lead one, and within GitHub is a paper on the food. I'd be happy to share it, but everything's all on GitHub. I don't know if the link to the paper is, we gotta get better at that. It's a PDF, and if you want, I can send it to you. If you just come up to me with your email, I'd be happy to forward it.
And in addition to what Brian said, I would also add that, you know, it took a lot of time and effort to identify the relationships and the partners and then have the conversations to think through ideas and use cases and, you know, all of that happening before it gets to the point of actually working through the use case. And so there were, you know, a number of ideas and you have to run it through some filter and criteria of what matters most. And so I would say that was an important part of the collaborative work. You know, that model that I showed earlier about the process of how to go about it. And you know, there is some commentary and work related to the models out there.
So the model will use all of that information in predicting We don't actually predict the blood lead level. We just predict whether or not they would be poisoned, because we don't want to, at least at this stage, we're not necessarily prioritizing a level of 15 over a level of 10 in doing the investigation. But yeah, beyond that, we're not, our plan is just to inspect the ones with the highest likelihood for poisoning. Does that clarify?
And you could, you know, as we talk about how does the healthcare delivery system integrate with the public health community, an example of this is really taking the model, integrating with the EMR as a clinical, public health, clinical decision support. So as folks, you know, as kids and families and mothers come to the clinic, it's an opportunity that raises a flag to have the discussion to decide, you know, someone potentially get tested much earlier, but it's also an opportunity to bring people who've been lost to follow up back into the clinical environment for testing. And then it allows for proactive approach and intervention, as Eric alluded to earlier, with homes and with the residents. I would encourage you to, the GitHub's probably the best place to go, so it's easy to craft an account there and look at the information there. There's one we're actually pursuing that's a little tougher, HIV, those that fall out of care. So that's been a challenge, and I think we've been working on trying to do it for 7 months. There's no team involved. We're speaking with folks within the department on how we can do this. I think it's smart and it's a thoughtful process. We don't just jump in and start saying, let's do predictive and bring a mathematician to PhD and say, knock it out for us. So we have to think about the different types of data. That's I alluded to earlier, open. It's very easy to try and you can experiment with that. But PHI type, I think, is tougher. We did, there were several in Kaggle they were saying no to. I think you, infant mortality was one, maybe. But I believe DSSG did that this year, though, yeah, with Illinois Department of Human Services. So that model is out. Is that out?
I'm not sure what the status is.
Okay, we don't know the status. So it's tougher, and it's dependent on the data, not only available, but the quality of it.
And I would say that the
you know, when we went through this to say what are the criteria, I think resource allocation is important. So if you look at and think about how other industries have used analytics, and specifically predictive analytics, that can give you also a filter for what kinds of problems that they were trying to address, to then translate that to public health. But I would say missed opportunities is one area. So can it help you identify missed opportunities? Neglecting high-risk cases, treating, and it'll help you distinguish between treating sure things in terms of treatment or interventions versus intervening in situations where you know it might not work, and allocation of resources. And sometimes, you know, there's a lot of learning we did about understanding what data works and what doesn't, and you don't really understand that until you go through the process. So you may develop a model to address a question, and work through it, and midway through it may not work. I mean, you know, you. So I think there has to be some flexibility to say, all right, we can recalibrate and try another approach, and then you have to set what threshold you have of how much you're going to invest in terms of resources and time.
Have you thought much about biases and whether this can source data? So I know for
No, that's definitely a concern in modeling in general, that there are biases in the data. But in our case, since the intervention that we're looking at, we consider to be a good one, it's the just looking at really the predictive accuracy really is, I would argue, sufficient to dealing with that bias. Because, for example, with lead, it's actually true that the exact neighborhoods, mostly the exact neighborhoods that you're talking about, that would have bias statistics in terms of crime or poverty or non-response in certain surveys, are really the neighborhoods that we're most targeting. And the intervention that we're proposing, for example, inspection and remediation, is to benefit those communities and not to... Yeah, I think it really depends on the problem, and I would argue specifically for the work that I've done, or that we've done on lead, that it's not so much of an issue. I agree that there are definitely issues about bias in machine learning models. For example, in policing is a really big one. Predictive policing, a lot of people have written about the issues there, and there's new methods in machine learning that are trying to overcome some of those issues, trying to build models that don't perpetuate the biases that exist in the data that the models are trained on and in the environment that they were built in. But yeah, that's an interesting question.
I can address the food one.
So by law, they still have to be inspected. So it's not necessarily picking on them in the same one. So if they're supposed to be inspected twice a year, we're just ordering them and bringing the inspection sooner than later. And they're not, the model is not always going to, it's built so that once they're inspected, they fall back. They're kicked out of the model. They can be inspected if someone calls in and makes a complaint, though. And so that doesn't have to, that's not related with the model. But yeah, we're following the policies so that the model follows the constructs of those policies that are already in place. We weren't making new policies with this model, though.
Good question, thanks.
Yeah, and I would add that it's also, as I was speaking to you earlier, I think it's predictive analysis is a tool, and so you have to think about it in the context of the question and problem. The question you're asking, the problem you're trying to solve, and kind of think about those biases and situations that you raised earlier.
I would just say stay tuned to Chicago.
It's not necessarily a coincidence that we're all here together on this table. I mean, as I alluded to earlier, that we've built the relationships and we've been working together for a number of years. And so there are new partners as well that come into the fold. I think it was facilitated by a number of things. One, Mayor Mantle's real leadership in innovation and technology, and really opening data up and engaging the civic tech community in Chicago. Two, that the Department of Innovation and Technology was a core partner in this work. Three, that there is just this
I think, great energy in Chicago around trying to help make the city better together. For the health department leadership, the commissioner, and others were very much invested and supported of this work. And fifth is that the programs actually cared about doing it, right? If the programs leadership, Jaron Butler, Dr. Kortloaf, and others were not really invested in it, then it doesn't work, because their insight's important. The insight of the people on their team is important. So even sort of the frontline workers on a, whether they're an inspector or a sanitarian, they have to see their contribution to the broader and bigger picture, and they have to be a partner in this too. So in the lead project, Emil, one of the epidemiologists was involved, the inspectors were involved. So I think that, and it's, I think having the permission to fail too and learn from that, I think all those things make it, create that environment, and being open and sharing and learning from each other.
I'm gonna add one more thing.
You can't just go up to partners and just say, this is what I want. I think, and same with Department of Innovation Technology. They're another city department. You can't just say, hey, start working with us. I think one of the key things we learned is matching people's missions and matching people's goals. If we can align our verticals with their verticals, they're more likely to accomplish the same goals. If we're going to try to organize data and create a dashboard of predictive analytics, well, can we throw in some of our projects in that project with another department? Data Science for Social Good, that's what they do. They have a fellowship every summer. And so we talk about ideas with them. We start building these relationships. So I think that is also key, that identify what your goals are and what your potential partners or collaborators will be too, so that you can go the same road.
What's that?
The Rodin. Oh, yeah, yeah. The Rodin project.
So the Department of Innovation Technology had kicked off one project around rodent baiting, predictive rodent baiting, and that also helped lay some of the groundwork for other agencies, you know, really particularly us, to, at the Department of Public, to be involved in that work.